It is a time of legend. The galaxy is in flames. The age of knowledge and enlightenment has ended. The age of darkness has begun.
So greetings and welcome to the 16th episode of the Fires of Betrayal podcast, a podcast dedicated to discussing the various games set in the Age of Darkness, as well as all the lore that surrounds them. In today's episode, I'm going to discuss, and well, we're going to discuss, how we weave stories in lore into our games. A huge part of the Horus Heresy setting is the setting itself, and after several conversations on the show recently, I've sort of realised that some people are a little scared about making up their own stories about the games, and I think that's a shame, so we're going to see what we can do about making it a less scary thing. In that regard, today I'm joined by Grant, who'll jump on in a minute. But before we go any further, I want to quickly loop to something from last week. Well, 2 weeks ago now. We were discussing all the free PDFs and the rules within, and there are two things that we omitted. The first one is where we completely didn't talk about Chaos Knights. That's on me. I forgot they existed, partly because I've been pretty underwhelmed with the rules for the Chaos Knights. We are going to talk about them in a future show, and they're going to be good, apparently. We'll talk about how we'll put them into our games. Additionally, there was a point on the demonic dominions for the Runestorm Demons. We oversighted something, or I oversighted. You could only have one single dominion for your entire army. And I know I put a bit of time to saying, oh, well, you could do a little bit here and a little bit there. It was pointed out that you can't do it that way, and I will withdraw some of my statements about the problems there is with the demons. I agree that I think in some places, yeah, lesser demons are very plain, and I probably tried to defend that point a little more than I should have done, but it's all good. We'll talk about demons a bit more in a future show. I've started having them on the table now, and they are very, very interesting. All of that said, let's get on to the main point of today's show. Talking about stories and lore. And in that regard, I'll introduce Grant, who is a delightful player I met from the Pyrex event up in Kansas City. In
pleasure to be here, Martin. Thank you for having me on the show.
It's the first time on the show, so how long have you been playing in the hobby and such?
Well, it's a complicated question. Technically, I've been playing Horus. I could say that it got started when I was much, much too young, reading White Dwarfs, you know, maybe 10, 12 years old, starting off. It was my great-grandmother's, I think maybe 98th birthday, so me and a big pack of the family went over to Germany, and we did a little European trip, and I saw a Games Workshop with a bunch of those old late 90s tacticals and one of those old rhinos, and I was hooked. You know, I was Googling it when I got home. Google was still a thing at the time. I'm relatively young, in terms of actually getting involved, I guess. Maybe early 2000s, definitely.
Okay.
I'd have to consult the family tree a little bit to see exactly where we entered in there.
Third edition time?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, fourth edition was my first rule book. Actually, I've got a copy of it over. Yeah, this fourth edition book was the first one that I ever got. So it would have been third edition that I was, you know, getting visually hooked. But played sporadically over the last couple of years, have only really gotten into it now that I've got the job to keep up with the ambition for the modeling here. So it's been about a year that I've been playing Horus Heresy. Second edition's my first one, and I'm really enjoying it so far.
Very common beat story for a lot of people who've been on this podcast. You know, we introduce the whole idea of Warhammer, chasing what it was then, and we end up in Horus Heresy now. I think, yeah, like many, second edition has been that sort of great way for people to join the community.
They put it all in plastic, you know?
Yes.
And that made it very accessible.
Were you doing 40k before second edition?
You know, not much. I played tail end of... Oh, boy. So, okay, so... I did a games club in college, and so I think I played around a little bit in 6th and 7th edition, you know, a lot of used miniatures or borrowing other people's armies. Played the very, very beginning of 8th, and then when I moved out of Chicago, I sold off any minis that I had at the time, and didn't look back for a good number of years. So yeah, that was the very briefest like kind of times in the space, but you know, I've been consuming a lot of Warhammer media in the interim, keeping up, you know, reading books, playing those Dawn of War games. So I've been a pretty big Warhammer fan, but the tabletop, it's been slower to come to that.
Yeah. Okay. That makes it's not not an uncommon story for many folk. It's always interesting when you hear other people's story, because I went through that period where I was like, very big in Warhammer in high school, 3rd edition, and then I stopped. And like, I kept up with it with the books and with Dawn of War, and then like getting back into it again was like, oh, it's been like 8 years, and now I have the money to build the army I always wanted to have.
And here you are.
Yeah. Yeah, okay. So we talked about how long you've been here for. Not very long. I think the important question is, what armies do you actually collect?
What armies don't I collect? I think would be a better question at this point. I got a used miniature, kind of a save the poor little miniature on the side of the road complex a little bit. So someone drops a, you know, hey, I'm leaving so and so minis out. I'm closing out the collection. I'm like, oh, I'll jump in there and see what I can do with them. So. First and foremost, Iron Hands are the darling. The my favorite chapter growing up. Loved the bionics, you know, the surface levels really spoke to me, and as I've gotten older, the self-doubt and loathing kind of externalized into, you know, really projecting that the fear that they have in themselves onto other people. I think it's ironically a really human story, and you get that for any of the legions if you pay close enough attention to them, right? They've all got their tragedies like that, but Iron Hands have the double benefit of not having very much written about them. So in terms of the first founding legions, they get that good effect you get with a lot of the, you know, the fill in the blank chapter that you kind of get in like early like 3rd edition, where it's like, you know, who are the Rainbow Warriors? We don't really know, but here they are printed in a book, and here's like two campaigns they fought.
Yeah, and they're, I mean, obviously they do suffer from the lack of the primary character in the actual novels, and
they got Shadrach Medusan, I think, is a guy. I haven't reached him in the books yet, but I'm very excited to when I get there.
He is an interesting, a bit of a spoiler, but I'll drop it now. One of my favorite things about Shadrach is the fact that he is a Terran, and he changes his name. So Shadrach Medusan isn't his real name, and that his real name is Smith. Like, he is someone Smith. Like he's an English, like, he's this weird, like, random dude.
Oh, yes, Old Albia, the great stable of all the greatest heroes, like Garo.
Yeah, and he's just like, oh, yeah, your name's Smith. It's just like, oh, okay. But he actually is, it is, like, wonderfully vanilla and not, and I like that about the Iron Hands. I do see what you're going for there with that sort of, yeah. They really haven't had a, let's think the right way. There hasn't been a Black Library author who's taken them on as their own.
Yeah, I enjoyed them in Fulgrim. It was nice to see them. They hit this weird place where they're not quite Space Wolves, but they've kind of got that warrior culture. They compare themselves to Space Wolves, I think, a little bit in that book in terms of their character. But you really have to kind of turn back to the Black Library, Black books to get decent characterization on anyone, and at that point it's just kind of blurbs in the style of like 4th edition and 3rd edition, and you know what they used to do back then.
In addition to your Iron Hands, is there any other big collection you've got? I know you've got...
just busted into Death Guard in a big way. Yeah, Death Guard around the table, working on some Thousand Suns coming up for a Burning of Prospero event. Let's see, I got a knight or two kicking around. Militia is a fun one. I like to take a lot of those War Games Atlantic plastic kits and see what I can make them do. So yeah, I think those are the big ones right now. Oh, and I got a pile of 3D printed xenomorph looking things from like the Alien franchise, and those are going to be demons at some point. So that's the sum total of it.
Okay, so we've gone over who you are.
Feel pretty well summed up.
Yeah, I mean, I mentioned earlier that the first time we met was through the Pyrex event up in Kansas City in May. But I was sort of aware of you from before that, because you went to the Pyrex event in Adepticon this year.
Yes, yeah, you clocked me back then.
Well, Lucas mentioned you at that point. By that point, you already started getting a bit of renown for telling stories.
Yeah, it was, I mean, it was my first Adepticon, right? You know, I'd never been before, and it was a borderline magical experience. Everything you would expect from the convention, you know, it kind of happened. So I had no idea how the structure of it worked, right? So I'd never heard of Phyrex, I'd never heard of any of the events there, and I just bought tickets for like the big apocalypse games, and you know, didn't get in anywhere else. So I'm just kind of wandering around the hall, and I see Lucas, and I'm like, "Hey, do you guys have any openings?" He's like, "Yeah, we always have players drop. Come back around." And you know, then suddenly I was entering in the second round, and it's just kind of snowballed from there.
Yeah. Do you play in all the days then?
I didn't. And yeah, I think I started second day. Played in the apocalypse game that evening, and I was playing some of the other events around there, so I was making my way around the room, but it was pretty limited that first time.
I'm hoping to go this year.
Tough with the you know, life and the getting out to Chicago.
Yeah,
unfortunately, yeah.
With it being it's the one of those rare times where it's in a lineup with full break, spring break, so I'll have the week off already. Which makes the trip workable. It's just, I don't know, it's a very intimidating con. There's so much going on there and a lot of competition to do everything.
Yes, that, you know, absolutely.
It's like, oh, that could be a lot.
Yeah, yeah. I've got a little advantage. I'm only an hour and a half away from the convention center presently, and I've got a mother-in-law that, future mother-in-law, that lives about 15 or so minutes away from where they hold it. So it's kind of a shoe-in for me. But we don't all have that. So
No.
If you can make it out, be a delight to see you, 100%. Well, that's where it gets started. You know?
So, you know, we've sort of covered, you know, who Grant is. Let's sort of talk about narratives. We're talking about the narratives we've written. I think I'll get started very briefly on my narrative. I've written a lot of stories over a long time, reference here and there already. But my story I wrote for the Pyrex Amber Strand events are probably my favorite I've ever done. It focuses on a character I created to lead my army, Marshal Theodosius, who is a word bearer who may be rebelling against the word bearers, if you read between the lines. He's took off a pile of Legion resources and gone to make his mark in an area away from the main force of word bearers, and sees himself as a master duelist and has slowly crept up the list of people the Imperium are worried about, to an extent where the official officio and assassinorum start thinking it's probably the best idea to put him down, which doesn't really work for them. Being pretty well warp-touched and on the path to demonhood. In the subtext of a lot of his stuff, you get the sense that he's actually on some form of quest for Tzeentch. I'm not sure whether anyone's come to that point yet. He's not... He's a manipulator, he's a schemer, and my headcanon is that eventually he will go off and become a Demon Prince of Tzeentch, unless something horrendous goes wrong and he ends up as a spawn somewhere, which also would be absolutely perfect for lore. But I'm writing mine in a big narrative. It's CC'd on, it's in the show notes. Yeah, Grant, what have you been putting together?
All right, yeah, so, and it's a little bittersweet to talk about it now because we're closing the chapter on the Iron Hands Clan Saimurk. Which I believe is, I think, an Arabic word for phoenix. The initial idea was it was this kind of collaborative presence, an R&D company between the Emperor's Children and the Iron Hands, and things got all mixed up in the betrayal period. So it was a lot of Iron Hands line troops and a lot of Emperor's Children support and officers of a more loyalist bent. Getting all mixed up together and winding up in Ferrix. But the characters that have kind of come to the fore here are a kind of diametrically opposed duo. We've got my praetor, Iron Captain Izada Sharp, named for the very excellent Sean Bean television serials from the 90s. I had a little veteran company with snipers, and so Sharp's rifles kind of became a little jokey reference in there. He's kind of a taciturn, you know, but a lot of the things that make Sean Bean's character really compelling don't gel with Space Marines. He's not a lover, you know, he doesn't have a lot going on besides some stuff comes up, you know, he's more personable, I think, the way that I've written him, but he's kind of a bit of a stone block, and that's kind of contrasted with, the fiery and frankly, sinister Adarak Hax, the equerry to the Iron Father of the Clan Company, and kind of a rival and sometimes enemy within the force. So these two kind of represent, you know, the two characters of the Iron Hands Legion, right? You got the jobs, the thing to do, gotta get it done, you know, professional, represented by the Iron Captain, and you've got the my dad is dead, everything is awful forever, let's go out in a blaze of bolter fire with the Herald. And so across the Ferrix narrative, there have been, I mean, they didn't have names when I played my first game at Ferrix, but I got to play, and this is jumping ahead a little bit, kind of my ethos when it comes to writing these stories is, you know, you take every part of the animal, right? So you got the game, you got the models that you're playing, and you've got what your opponent's bringing to the table, and you can chop it all up and add it together. So, from the very first moment when I got kind of jumbled from table to table, I was supposed to be fighting Night Lords and ended up going up against Loyalist Space Wolves, it became sort of a running theme for this force to kind of get debacled into fighting Loyalist forces by mistake, much to you know, the overall war effort's ultimate you know, denigration. So you know, it's the Herald kind of leading people into disaster situations, and the Praetor just outside of the zone of influence, running into interesting NPCs and interacting with the very cool Ferrix rules, and kind of having his own story that doesn't end up involving him in the mission, usually very much. So that's all come to a head at the last Kansas City event in September. I'm writing up a post show notes. The Legion cast guys who I got to run into there, they ended up kind of giving me a really good out. And I'd love to talk about that if we have time. But yeah, keeping it very short and brief, their story has wrapped up in a way I'm very satisfied with for now. And we'll be moving into a traitor side of the story come Adepticon next year.
Nice. Picking up with Death Guard?
Yes, yeah. I was very interested in when the Ferrix Praetor rules dropped, and the Death Guards thing was a Death Shroud. I got to thinking, like, how does a Death Shroud end up becoming like a leader if they're mostly sworn to silence? So that's the question that I want to tackle with this guy. How do you distinguish yourself when, you know, you're not allowed to communicate with your fellows? So we'll find out.
Yeah, that's an interesting. Yeah. Now, I mean, before we sort of move away from what we're doing, that's sort of where I haven't finished writing my story for the Amistrad myself. I've got a few more bits to go into that final narrative, because I've also been distracted by what's going to be next year's big story, which is going to be about my militia, who are nominally linked to my word bearers, but are the citizens of the Phyrexian system, right, rising up against the imposition of order and all that means.
I mean, so there's a lot of like, you know, the ancient tech in the Ferrix cluster ends up getting a lot of focus. But there are farm tables.
Yeah.
You know, there are signs of human habitation in a very imperial facing way. So you know that there's gotta be millions of these dregs hanging out in the little corners of Ferrix. Yeah. I can't imagine a better resource pool for a word bearer to make a real crusade.
Yeah, and it gives me an excuse because the whole system's meant to be an industrial cluster, and I wanted a force of cultists that would allow me to take a lot of tanks. So I'm building an industrialized, like, we've got a pile of Lehman Russes that the Forge World's been churning out. I've got piles of guys and some stuff that doesn't look quite imperial hidden away. I'm excited about it, and I think it will look really good as part of it's good for the next step of the story, I think. I always have a pretty strong story when I'm building my armies, like, even outside of the narrative games like we've been doing with the Phyrexian team. So when I started collecting my word bearers and I was just looking at the content of the Age of Darkness box, I'd sketched out like the storyline, and I had my Praetor in Terminator Omni and his Terminator bodyguard, and they were part of this other company, and the other dudes who were the main part of the rest of the army. And about February, I decided I really didn't like how it was working on the table. And Lucas has been starting to talk about the Kansas City event. And I was like, well, I think I want to do something else. And I created my brand new Praetor and changed the story of my force and started to write a story that tied into events of the Amber Strand. Very particularly that story arc. I'm not sure what I'm doing now. Phyrexian stories moving past the Amber Strand. It's an interesting thought for myself, but
well, I would go so far as to say I don't think any singular character distinguished themselves across the whole event quite as much as Theodosius. And what I think is really interesting is the way that your initial report ended up kind of aligning with the way that it developed. I'm not sure if you've, you know, commented on this or thought about this, but your initial fiction there is kind of an intelligence report from the Imperial perspective. Is that correct? The Loyalist side.
Yes.
Kind of
so that's
a threat assessment.
I had this been my writing style for like backstories forever. I got really hooked a couple of years ago by the novel Dracula, where it's not written like narratively, like not written in the narrative. You're reading the narrative through other people's words.
Yeah.
And I realized
it's a strong way to do it.
It works really well for backgrounds like sort of stories we're telling.
You can work ambiguity into it in a lot of ways.
Absolutely. So like I had, must have been getting close to 10 years ago now. When I first got back into Warhammer, I was building a brand new chapter for 40K. I think they were the Illuminated Dragoons was the name of them. And I built like the whole world, the home world, and I built all the lore. And the way I was writing the lore was just on a series of reports. And that just became my 40K writing style. And that's definitely been the way it's been continued into the Amber Strand. For those who care about the narratives we're referencing, I'm going to throw some links in the show notes. You'll have a link to my one and probably link to some of Grant's as well when they come up.
might take a bit of a different form. I like the split it between kind of a long form fiction, which is spiraling out of control. I'm presently working on what may very well be the first Ferrix fan novel. We'll see how that develops. Kind of a campaign diary of the Amber Strand, making it all fit together. And it's been kind of a passion project. So your narrative definitely put a lot of inspiration in there. I think this sort of stuff doesn't happen without collaboration of a lot of people playing a lot of games. So it's the shorter stuff, the brief ones, you know, like here's one page for the opponent to say, like, you know, who are the characters? Why are they here? What are they doing? I think it's good to have a digestible thing, but you can work a lot of detail into longer form and shorter form. So, you know, I think it just goes to show you, whatever your level of preference is, whether you're, you know, an insane person like me and you want to you want to write a book for yourself, more or less, or, you know, you want to do this like very interesting, you know, in the fiction report where you can use the kind of the unreliable narrator, right? You got the character who's writing, mm-hmm. the assumed character, and they don't know everything, you know, so you've got blank spots. You can change things up down the line if stuff makes sense or add stuff. And in your case, with Theodosius's threat assessment, it ended up kind of leading very nicely into a series of failed assassination attempts, as, you know, kind of special operations unit after unit was gunning for this word bearer and just could not put him down. And his power only grew as they, yes. they attempted to kill him.
Well, yeah, I mean, I still need to finish writing the last couple of games up for Ambustrand Part 2, because the last round of games, it got to a ridiculous level when the fantastic organizers of the system decided that assassins could shoot across tables towards my character, providing was in range. So,
oh boy, but he made it, right? He made it through.
Yes. Oh yes, absolutely.
Yeah,
It didn't involve him cowering in a land raider at all.
Hey, listen, you do what you have to do when the entire Imperial war machine is directed at you. It's a great opportunity to make sure that they're not looking anywhere else.
Yeah.
And it completely turned around the course of the event, you know. It became Theodosius's grand strategy. The infamous massacre in the tunnels, you know, with the sentries. Looking back at it now as part of a bigger master plan, you know, it all fits together very, very nicely and very neatly. And so I think, in a way that very few players can say, I think you've really left your mark on Ferrix as a whole. And it's kind of, I would say, it's something to aspire to for anybody out there looking to, you know, invest a little bit of lore time into their armies.
So I think what we need to sort of look at talking about now is, obviously, me and you have written a lot, and it seems that both of us could write a lot more about everything. What I really want to sort of spend the chunk of today's show talking about is how we would advise other people to do what we've been doing.
And I'm so glad you're asking this question, because there are a lot of people out there I know that have a lot of passion for their armies, you know, put a lot of work into them. And the degree that you can kind of take that investment and use it as like a force multiplier in your own writing to be like, okay, so I really care about these guys, so I'm going to think about them very hard. It's a great way to, you know, really get into the hobby. So it's one of my favorite things to talk about for sure.
The thing I'm going to say right now is that this is not just about Pyrex. This is about all wargaming. I think it's
right. The your dudes, kind of mindset where they're, you know, Gilliman's doing his thing, you know, whatever's going on in the current 40K narrative, you know, it'll churn on, but your guys, you know, whether you're playing bolt action and you've got like an interesting little company that ties into some historical footnotes, you like whatever you're playing, the guys you're bringing to the table are always going to be the most important to you. And so knowing what's going on with them and keeping the great legends that you're making on the table, you know, loses and wins, it's something special you can do in this hobby that you really can't replicate in a lot of other places.
No, I mean, I spent a good chunk of my time not wargaming back in the day, LARPing, and you can do it there, but I find my ability to tell stories in wargaming is actually far greater than I was able to then. I'm not just talking about one single character. I've got an army of characters, quite literally, that I can tell different perspectives. There are multiple stories you can tell simultaneously, which is really scary. I know for a lot of people, oh yeah, but that's a lot of writing. So let's start at the simple level. So, I mean, obviously, we've sort of talked about some big game. Grant's mentioned writing a book of the like, and it's like, yes, that's something you can do. But actually, the best thing to do is start really small.
Nobody else is doing it. Yeah, nobody should be doing that, frankly. It's It's a terrible waste of time, and I wouldn't advise anybody go that far. You can get just as much out of it with a page, you know, about the stuff that really matters with your guys.
Me, I think we'll start at the very basics, which is how do we tell... We're playing a game of Horus Heresy. It's not in any larger events.
Yes.
How do we tell a story with it?
Well, you start out by looking at the armies involved, I think.
Yep.
You know? You see, the first thing you should do whenever you're going to play a game of Horus Heresy, you go over to your opponent. If you don't know them, you say, "Hi, my name is so-and-so. Let me look at your models. I think they're wonderful." And 9 times out of 10, that's going to be your true reaction, you know?
Yeah.
Ask your opponent about their force, you know, get to know them a little bit more. It's a social hobby, so, you know, enjoy that to the fullest extent.
Yeah, and just literally by looking at your armies and looking at the way they complement, and don't necessarily have to make any special changes to your lists. Just sit down and look at the two armies and then go, why would these guys be fighting?
Yeah, and Horus Heresy is a really good setting for that. So 40K's got the idea that, you know, everybody's fighting all the time. The Imperium's fighting itself constantly. All the aliens hate each other, you know, and that's useful, but it's also kind of directionless. So you can always say, well, I guess the Tau colony is being raided again. You know, yeah. Who cares? But with Horus Heresy, it's specific and it's tragic. So... Mm-hmm. It's not just like the Custodes are fighting the Ultramarines. Well, why would they be doing that? That doesn't make any sense. It's like the Custodes are slaughtering the Ultramarines under this veil of suspicion. It could be smoke in the air. It could be a misunderstanding. But, you know, with the exception, of course, of some Chaos guys that get to stick around, everybody's going to die. Look at your Horus Heresy army. Look at all your tacticals. Look at your banner bearers. Look at all these heroes. These guys all die within the next like 200 to 300 years at absolute maximum. Most of them probably in the next 15 to 30 minutes once they're on the tabletop.
When deciding like how that battle goes, a good piece of advice I would offer is whatever your first thought is, invert it. Example being. The last big game I played was two militia armies fighting off against some Blood Angels and Dark Angels. And obviously, we were playing on this big city map, and the initial thought was, well, obviously, the Marines are attacking the militia. Well, we went, actually, what if the aggressive force here is the militia? The militia is attacking the Dark Angels that are hunkering down in the city, and the Blood Angel Droppod army that, you know, comes across as this really offensive force is actually... the reinforcements arriving on defense.
It's a more interesting story that way, you know? I mean, Space Marines roll over militia all the time. But you look at some of the most famous Space Marine art, you got, like, the Crimson Fist Last Stand. You know, that's part of the character, too.
Yeah, and even though the militia brought this big set of fortifications, clearly this was just the outrun of trench work. So obviously, there's been the battle itself wasn't the full story. The battle had been... the final moments of what had been a long siege of the Dark Angels withstanding bombardment from the militia, and the militia making a final charge to try and do what they needed to be done before the Blood Angels arrived. And
that's a compelling narrative.
Yeah. The game played really well, and it played out similar to that, because we made a small alteration to the battlefield to make sure the game felt right. We set the scenery up a bit more after that. And the game, by the end of the game, we were like, well, actually, the Blood Angels arrived, but they landed in the... They didn't expect the militia to attack, so they landed kind of out of position. That meant eventually the militia were able to secure the city, and we're able to tell the story. And it was that simple.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's another important thing to keep in mind. The assumption of the Warhammer 40,000 battle and the Warhammer 30,000 battle by extension is that this on the tabletop is the absolute crucible of a much larger event. So, you know, you're throwing scores of models down on the table. They're dying in droves, but this is the most intense and, you know, most important engagement of the moment. So treat it with that gravity. You know, you guys are doing the battle at Helm's Deep every time you light Marines on a table.
Yeah, and actually, you bring up a great point there. In fact, by referencing Lord of the Rings, I'm hoping most people listening to this podcast will have listened to Lord of the Rings or read Lord of the Rings or watched the movie. Battles in Lord of the Rings don't make up greater than 20% of the actual movies or books. A lot of it is is getting ready for it or the time after it.
Yes, yeah.
And that's kind of the same with our narratives. A good narrative is, why were these guys getting to the table? And what happens when they leave the table?
I agree with that 100%.
If you sit down and write a story, you really do not want to be writing a story about my tactical marine shot the last cannon marines, the last cannon marine shot back.
Yeah. Well, you know that you can have your Saving Private Ryan moment where your last cannon marines turn on the little bolt sniper there, and you lose a treasured character. But that movie itself, it's a lot of guys in fatigues walking and talking about what they care about, and you know what the situation is and how they feel about it. And then you have a couple very brief and intense moments where you lose most of them. And yeah, that's the way it's done.
Yeah. And so taking it to that next step further, when you start trying to link ideas up, you mentioned the Sharp books earlier, or TV shows, because I find the Sharp TV series to be the magic formula for telling a war narrative. You have a little skirmish at the start, a whole chunk of exposition of talking and setting up, and then a battle and a little bit of wrap up.
Yes. Yeah, it's tried and true.
Yeah, and if you can frame, like, if you're playing just a random pickup game with a buddy, you put your two armies together, you have that conversation, and you frame the conflict. I mean, going back to the earlier one you mentioned, Ultramarines versus Custodes.
Yes.
Sure, Custodes coming in slaughtering the Ultramarines, but invert the story. Skirmish, the initial battle, was the Custodes slaughtered some civilians or something. They had to do something. And this is the Ultramarine showing up to go, no.
It says a lot more about both armies. You know, the Custodes have that emotionless side to them where they're kind of disregarding human life. The worst, some would say, of what the Emperor makes at its pinnacle. You know, the tool without humanity. And then the Ultramarines, you know, everyone's favorite John Cena in blue, the real heroes, the good guys. I had a very similar experience with my first battle in Ferrix. I think I alluded to this a little bit earlier, but when I first came on, and I don't remember his name, but there was a Night Lords player who had this very impressive armored company. You know, a lot of old style like Predators and Land Raiders with those very kind of bulbous like 80s looks to them. So I was engaging with another player, you know, shook hands, like, hey, looking forward to playing you. I hear someone call out, like, hey, you know, this guy, you know, he needs an opponent. And I'm thinking to myself, like, well, I would be delighted. I saw him get blown up the table twice in the Apocalypse game the previous day. His models looked great, you know, so I run over there. Oh, you know, sorry, he had already gotten a fill-in at that point. Run into my previous guy. Oh, sorry, I got a...
Yeah.
Got another player while you were gone. So I ended up doing a loyalist versus loyalist battle against this wonderful gentleman from Indiana who had Lehman Russ himself right before the Primarchs and other unique characters got kind of delisted from Ferrix. And it was this breach where, you know, I had Iron Hands and Land Raiders. He had Space Wolves and Land Raiders. There was a big broken wall. And we duked it out. And it was a loss for the Iron Hands. You know, the Herald was there in the center. I mentioned him before, Adarak Hax, not yet named, but this is where he gets his characterization from. We ended up figuring it out. You know, the Night Lord's attack was a feint. It led to these Space Wolves trying to get out of system, running into a big block of Iron Hands. The Praetor was out, you know, looking at a cool Archaeotech pistol in the corner, and his kind of bloodthirsty second in command caused a debacle that ended with Lehman Russ slamming his head up and down into some rubble and wasting a lot of everyone's time, while a different Night Lords player in a matched table that kind of shared the same wall assassinated, if you were at Adepticon 2023, John Wick. A man and a dog became a popular figure. So they were killed on the table right next to ours. And so the narrative there becomes the Iron Hands have now not only shamed themselves in front of a Primarch, they've allowed the Night Lords to win a massive like tactical victory here. And at that point, you know, they did a little action in the boarding action, but censure and... suspicion kind of became the watchwords for the army at that point, and it gave characterization to these profiles that at that point were just you know, models on the table. So my first piece of advice for getting started for anybody, you know, other than like, look at what your opponent's got, you know, figure out why you guys are going to be engaging, is to look at your collection, you know, whether you're collecting based on whatever your favorite legion or force, militia, cults, demons, you know, mechanicum, whatever it happens to be, or whether you're kind of collecting from a wargamer's perspective, you know, what kind of armies do you like to play? Maybe you like to shoot, maybe you like to sneak. However you start, once you've got your army, really take some time to figure out, you know, what do each of these units mean? Because the advantage of Horus Heresy as a setting is how specific all of the characters are. And it's not just like, you know, capital C characters, the unit type. A tactical squad means something. They've got, they've come from somewhere. They, you know, they've got Legion colors. They've got a culture. And the same is true with every other unit in the game. Those little italicized blurbs on the left-hand side or the right-hand side of the page are really useful if you want to get into narrative planning.
Absolutely. So picking up from your story you just started, I think there's something that we probably should address before we get too much further. Named characters. Now, obviously, in the Phyrexian games, they aren't a thing anymore. We've switched them out for our customizable characters. But having a named character on the table doesn't stop narrative from happening. It just changes the way the narrative's going to occur. A named character comes with their own story. So you start having to be like, so where does this particular incident fit in that larger narrative? And within the craziness of the Horus Heresy, there is enough places for nearly every character to have met.
Absolutely.
It does require a little bit more knowledge, perhaps, of the character. And if you want to tell a really evocative story with a named character, it does serve you well to know that character's timeline. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, you can get by, if it's your dudes, and this is some personal bias on my part, it's the way I prefer to play is, you know, a minimum of unique characters to really get some freedom to, you know, end up in any situation you want. But if you're bringing unique characters to the table, you can really kind of follow their path out there. There's a lot of great resources. Wikis are a good start. You know, they got a lot of cited sources with books. But what's Fafnir Ran? Is he the Imperial Fist?
Yes.
With the two axes? Yeah, what's he been up to? You know, he's got a couple books about him, so if you like him on the table, check him out, you know? Yeah. Or if the books led you to the guy on the table, you know, hey, so much the better, you know what he's all about.
Yeah, and I think that's just kind of you can get a little lost, especially with things like Perix out there being like, hey, we don't do named characters because we want to tell a narrative. You can do both. It just becomes a lot easier to tell your own story if only your characters are there. Because then everything you do is your own material. Your own creation in the Warhammer play space, rather than having to be a lot more beholden to someone else's creation. I think it's a better way to put it.
Yeah, I think it gives you a framework. I think it's an excellent point there about, you know, there is a distinction between like writing an entirely original property and, you know, having some background fluff for your army, because it's a very guided experience in two ways, right? There's an existing Horus Heresy world out there, and I would be shocked to meet someone that played Horus Heresy and knew nothing about the setting, right? This is a man that does not exist. If you do exist, please write Martin an email about your experience, and
yes,
hopefully he can talk about it on a future episode of the podcast. So, you know, that person does not exist, but also the game itself is a guided experience, right? You know, the way that the pieces move together, you've got characters that are going to do certain roles or certain jobs. You know, you're going to expect your veterans to be good melee fighters, and you're going to expect a militia squad to crumple in the face of them. So when you're writing narratives in the moment, the best things to look for are subversions of these expectations, right? Everybody expects the Praetor to, you know, face roll over lesser fighters. But if he gets, for instance, from the most recent Kansas City event, overwhelmed by a horde of lesser demons with his little impromptu retinue because he's failed to hold the line check, and it costs you a victory down to a draw. A very fun game, I'll say. Great opener there. That tells you a lot about the character of your model in a way that, you know, unit performing as expected might not necessarily. The flip side is true, too. You know, you can have a militia hero rise out from the ranks and tag a dreadnought with a crack grenade, and suddenly maybe you've got a new force commander in the future.
And I think this sort of segues onto the sort of next important point. Like, one of the strong things about creating a narrative beyond just the individual battle is talking about individual characters. Characters with a big C, not necessarily the characters of, like, this is a HQ unit, but, like, yes. Stories that follow from one game to the other isn't necessarily about your entire army. It is about, well, my Praetor, who was always fleeing, well, what does he do now?
Yeah. And sometimes the story ends, you know? You have an opportunity to, if you don't like a unit, you can kill them off. Or if you do like a unit, you can kill them off, and then you're a real big hero in my book. Look at the archetypical, do you know Captain Tycho, of the Blood Angels, Captain Tycho?
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, he's a great example, right? He's a white dwarf battle report character that ends up having this whole saga, you know, kind of enshrined in canon now, in a way that, you know, doesn't happen as much these days, but that starts with just a captain getting smashed by a weird boy, I think, in that battle report, and then
I believe so, and then he becomes, they make the model for him, and he sticks around forever, and he goes through this different, yeah, and they eventually kill him off. But that doesn't end his story, because the model is still around, you can still play games in the period where he was alive.
I mean, you're talking to an Iron Hands main, right? Like, our guys get wiped out in the first moment of the Heresy, but you still, you know, they poke around, you know? Anyone out there that wants to run the Gorgon on the table, my fullest respect. He had a very busy 15 minutes leading up to the Fulgrim decapitation. He got in a lot of fights in between here and there.
Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, but that sort of brings a point. Like, if you have a character and you've told a story with him and you've complete and the story is over, like, you've been like, okay, well, that was the point when my hero dies. It doesn't mean that a game 2 years from now can't have that character in it again. It just means that's one that's set before he died.
Yeah, so this is actually something for us to talk about a little bit. An interesting little tidbit. So Eric, a member of the Furyx team, we were talking about some of the concepts behind the tables, right? So they've got, have you seen their legacy table for the Amber Strand yet? Have they talked to you about
that? I haven't yet, no.
So there's going to be those drones are here to stay on one particular table. But the concept behind that table and I believe the Nihonto crash site, are that they're kind of these time-locked, outside-of-narrative moments that, you know, the Furyx system will march on. Drones aren't always going to be a part of that, but anybody can kind of return to these, like, historical moments, which puts, I think, our particular intersection of narratives in a really interesting position, where that big final climactic battle happened on a crash site of a ship that, as of the Amber Strand, had not yet been discovered. So we've got some interesting questions that pop up there. You know, is that a far-flung fight in the future? Is that you know, some time travel? Is it a suspiciously similar ship crash? That's the kind of questions that you can, you know, ask your fellow players, and depending on their level of interest, really engage in.
Yeah. So once again, jumping to talk about Sharp for a second in narrative. I think it's the Sharp series, the books, are a case in point, and I'm presuming there is a percentage of listeners who read the Sharp books. But so Bernard Cornwell, he started his Sharp series in a book that is now like book 10 of the chronology.
Because
he wrote that first book, and then he has gone back to fill in a pile of other books. And so he wrote from the first book with Sharp, getting, like, in Spain. He wrote through to the end of the war. They went back and rewrote, like, Sharp's time in India up to the start of the war. And they did a few random infill books. And then he went and wrote from the end of the war to Sharp's like I think he may die in the last book, and now he's gone back and writing another book that's just going to slot in the middle of the timeline again.
So Sharp the novel series, and then Sharp's Rifles is, I think, the name of the television serial, is a series of Napoleonic war stories where Sean Bean plays a British enlisted man who kind of rises through circumstance to the role of an officer, and it marks his kind of ups and downs throughout the, mm-hmm. the Napoleonic campaign in Europe.
Yeah. I am.
That'll clue in people that, and you can watch it for free on YouTube with baked in Spanish subtitles if you're interested. And the books are out there too, obviously.
We can spend the $7.40 a season like I've been doing on YouTube.
Hey, that, you know what? That is supporting the official release, I imagine, in a very useful way.
Yeah, and if you have an Audible membership, all of the books are free on Audible at the moment. It's part of the Audible library.
Oh, that's incredible, actually, because I've got the Audible subscription, and so my one credit a month goes to slowly getting through the Horus Heresy series, so I thought I would never hear another audiobook again. So that's great news for me.
Yeah, no, and they are really good. So one thing I really enjoy, I mean, they are, to me, have been a template book of how to do a lot of this stuff, because one of the things Bernard Cromwell does at the end of his books is he has his, like, final chapter. The story's wrapped up, and the final chapter is his historical notes, in which he apologizes to a variety of people for stealing their glory, and saying, in these battles, these folk did this, but Sharp did it.
You know, that brings up another really important thing. If historical isn't your bag, and, you know, it should be. It's a very fun genre, but, you know, it takes all kinds, all tastes. If you're purely looking in the realm of, you know, Warhammer, I think the Sisyphus Cain novels follow a very similar trajectory of, yes. you know, kind of coy after the fact commentary, and then coy in the moment after the fact commentary. There's a lot of layers of time in the Cain novels, but it throws all around his career. You know, sometimes he's a young man, sometimes he's an old man, but the stories come out in kind of whatever order the author decides is you know, the best one to tell next. So you can do the same thing with your characters. You never have to say goodbye until you sell the model or leave it in an accident or something.
Yeah. And I think that's really important, because I think there is some gravity in looping back to the point we're making. There's a bit of gravity in being able to say, hey, his characters have died. This was his final battle. But being able to not put away the model, I think, being able to still pull it out is kind of important, because, yeah, we still want to play with our toys. But killing off your Praetor is a great reason to make a new one, and I love building HQ models more than I like building tactical marines.
I don't know if you've had a chance to touch base with the Ferrix crew, but I know that there's been some interest in immortalizing Theodosius as the tyrant of the Amber Strand in the future. Any thoughts on that?
I don't know. I haven't sat down and talked to Lucas properly about it, but the answer would probably be yeah. we'll see what I end up doing, because I have like thoughts as far as path goes.
I mean, imagine like in a year or two, if like the ascension the spawnification of Theodosius becomes like a story arc in itself for one of these runs, that'd be. I mean, you know, you look at I think if you play role playing games, if you play, you know, Dungeons and Dragons, it's a good place to look for a lot of the same tips. You know, if you want to get online and be like, you know, how can I make my guy fleshed out? How can I step away from the cookie cutter narratives that kind of stem up? A lot of it comes from letting emergent gameplay moments happen. You know, like I want to really caution people. Unless you're having fun doing it, don't write more backstory than you can chew, right? Like you wanna get the real memories happen, not when you make level one human fighter, but when level one human fighter becomes like level three human fighter and he's fighting a minotaur and he's on his last breath and he loses an arm or he gets a cool thing, you know. Same thing with your praetor. Everyone loves Paragon Blade Praetor, but when he gets a murderous strike off on a demon, that's something special.
And actually, that's I think this is a really important point. You don't need to write the story after the game. Not those first 10 minutes after it. Most of the sort of story I've wrote up for Theodosius was written weeks, if not months, after the game. After the game, have just finished a game of Horus Heresy, and I'm ready to do something else. But I've taken some photos of the game, and I remember what the game is like, and I make a few notes occasionally about how the game played out. And then when I sit down to write my little, like, report about it, yeah, if the memory's been a bit blurred, that's fine.
We
remember the key points of that game, and then I write something down, and then I share it with my buddy who I play the game with, and they're like, oh yeah, I remember that, that was cool. Like,
yeah, the stuff that sticks out in memory is the stuff that's important. You know, in the moment you've just finished it's a competition. It's not competitive. You know, I think nobody should be sitting down at one of these events looking to clear house and win. There's no point to it, right? But it's you've won or you've lost or you've drawn out, and there's moments tied there that may be helpful for the story or may not be. So you give it time. You let it cook.
Yeah, and it's like, you know, I mean, so one of the things that Games Workshop have done recently that I really enjoy in 40K is their Crusade system. So just stepping from Heresy for a second, I'm going to talk about my Orc story, because I think it is so different from everything we discussed today. I had a Crusade force for my Orcs, and the way their story worked was simply, after every game, a couple of days later, I would write like a 3-sentence like blurb about what the Orcs did next. How did they get from that one battle to the next battle? And I joined up the games. I didn't do it while I was at my game weekends. I did it, like, I think I did the bulk of it one day when I was sitting at her car shop waiting for my car to be repaired, just sitting there on my phone, just joining the dots. And I had a draft outline.
I do want to say, like, inspiration can strike you at any time. So if you, in the moment, I definitely agree that, like, you know, the moment right after isn't the point where you have to sit down like the chronicler and get it all out. But, you know, if you're a note taking type, jotting down a couple things that you noticed or enjoyed at the time, you know, it can jog the memory later on. But I think ultimately, I mean, the best resource I think for these narratives is going to be your opponent. You know. Because you've got your own experience when you walk on there, and you've got your own guys and your own idea of them, but it takes two to tango in any of these games. So, you know, talk it out with them. What did they see? What did they notice? They might have, you know, seen something that you didn't in the moment. Or like, I would have never known about Theodosius's assassin problem if I hadn't, you know, come up to you and been like, hey, just so you know, we might have a game lined up in the next 2 days, and I've got many anti-psychic NPCs hanging around with me.
That itself, I mean, going back to the idea of emergent gameplay, that was, like, I didn't go out my way to be like, oh, I'm going to fight all these assassins. Just...
the assassins came to you.
It became noticeable very quickly that, hang on a minute, and then the story just sort of grew. And a few moments of battle.
For my part, I was being stalked by those, those Amble robots, the Necromunda ones. In 3 out of 4 of my games for that Kansas City Amber Strand event, my Praetor and his tactical squad walked onto a point, were ambushed by an Amble, spent the entire game fighting it, and then did nothing else. So we had kind of a cat and mouse thing going on with this NPC. And then at that Zone Mortalis game, you know, the very famous Ferix Apocalypse Zone Mortalis games, if you haven't had a chance to do it, I mean, get on it. It is a hell of a time.
It did sound like the one in KTC was the last one was really good.
Yeah, I'd love, I mean, that. So that's, in a lot of ways, that's my capstone, you know, for this Iron Hand story. Those fine gentlemen over at Legion Cast really, I mean, they really helped me put a nice little note on it. I think actually, is Brandon the Dark Angel player? Is that?
Yes.
Yeah. So he and I just happened to, he, you know, he, This happened to both of the Dark Angels players at the events, I think, but the classic problem I think any Alpha Legion or Dark Angels player is going to have is, you know, like, well, we have too many Loyalists or too many Traitor players. Who's playing Alphas or Dark Angels? You're flipping sides. You know, that classic conundrum. So I had an inkling that, you know, Hex has been a nasty guy. You know, he's been doing cheap tricks in a lot of these games. He's kind of shown his true colors. Maybe he does his Lucius, you know, his Lucius of the Emperor's Children moment and flip sides. And, you know, Brandon was like, well, absolutely, I'd love to play Loyalist. It's what I came to do. Mm-hmm. So we ended up flipping sides. And I'm not sure how much you heard about the specifics, but Warwick 10-man suzerain squad penned up the entire Traitor Iron Hands force, and in a really brutal series of engagements, it ended up just being, you know, one wounded Praetor and one suzerain left, you know, a two dead dreadnoughts, 30 dead Terminators, a real you know, slaughterhouse. And we ended up doing a little photo shoot afterwards with kind of a prisoner exchange where, you know, my Iron Hands Praetor was given the traitor back and ended up kind of swearing a degree of allegiance to Imperium Secundus. So, you know, out to those Legion cast guys, you really helped me put a very nice cap on these guys for now. And who knows how they'll come back in the future, but it was a good place to end it.
And I just want to leave Brad. So I was thinking of Brandon when the idea of this conversation came to me. He had been complaining about trying to write story, yet he threw together a really incredible little narrative explaining why
this. I read this.
Dark Angels were on the, you know, wrong side of the fight.
On the traitor side of things.
Yes, yeah. And being like, it wasn't their fault. They were being led around by an Alpha Legion. And it was just, but it was a very well done story. Another one that will be found in the links to the show.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think it's a great example of, he went to the event, he played five rounds, and he wasn't telling a story through it. But then he took a few moments, and then he was able to tell a story. And it's now like, it's now a full linchpin that, and I know someone else is going to be able to grab a hold of.
Yeah. Yeah, 100%.
I read it, and I immediately regretted the fact that I hadn't got an Alpha Legion army of my own.
Well, so, you know, someone out there, I think I saw an Alpha Legion player like comment after at some point there. I know Eric, again, of the Furyx team is working on his Alpha Legion, so maybe there will be some ties in there as well. But honestly, from the Amber Strand on, I don't know, I don't think this bore out in the other games, but our initial engagement was a lot of Ultramarines on both sides being very confused and kind of flipping tables and, you know, getting into all kinds of some real drop site confusion there.
I mean, especially that first KC event, they were all over the place, which was great.
Yeah, it was half Ultramarines, and I remember, you know, sometimes you get like the chronology can help you tell stories. Mm-hmm. You don't have to like hold to it. You know, for instance, in my head, the touching moment of like an Ultramarine being like, you were like the, I'm so sorry, here's this idiot that, you know, betrayed the Imperium, take my hand. You know, that kind of comes as a bit of a wet blanket when the very next game, I ended up just getting absolutely rolled over by Dark Angels. Mm-hmm. in a very similar position. So the idea now that, you know, the Dark Angel rolling over happens, the survivors get picked up, and then the conversation happens, that smacks better of narrative to me. But in a lot of cases, that immediate lead-in can be really, really interesting. Like, you know, how do we get from point A to point B? If you can find a connection, that's where the meat is. That's where you get the really surprising twist. But, you know, don't hold yourself to it.
Oh, yeah, and that's, I'm trying to think of another good example on that regard.
Well, we alluded to it, the slaughter in the tunnels during that first Kansas City Zone Mortalis game. They were testing out mechanics for those drones, right? So they didn't know how any of it was going to go off. And the answer was 60% of miniatures will be killed by drones.
Yeah, it was a very, very scary game. The drones killed everyone, apart from my word bearers that I hadn't. I was planning on doing some late game commitments, and we didn't get to the late game, so they just ran away.
Yeah.
But that became the big story that, you know, the word bearers just turn around and go, nope.
But, you know, Zinch has maybe given you a little bit of insight into the next step to take. So it's still surprising to see a lightning drone popping up, but you're a little bit more prepared than the average lay Thunder Warrior, which I can't believe I forgot to mention my my Thunder Warrior custodies, my pride and joy, dead on the fields of the Amber Strand.
I was going to loop back to that, because I think that's the next sort of, the next, like, final, so not necessarily final step, but the icing on, like, these stories is not being afraid to do big things. I think the great example of that is your Thunder Warriors. So for the Amber Strand Part 1...
Oh, boy. The Iron Hands, like, wiki dive that preceded this idea was... And it's all thanks to Ferex, honestly. I would never have gotten these Thunder Warrior Custodes models if I hadn't gotten a coupon at Adepticon for Tortuga Bay, who's got a really cool collection of proxies there. So, you know, that all comes together. Thunder Warriors, everyone loves them. They're extremely dead by and large. By that time in the Horus Heresy and Iron Hands, who, you know, I was collecting and will. This is probably the only collection that I'm never going to let go of. They're too precious to me. But, you know, they're one of the very few factions at the time that are playing around with Warhammer Necromancy. So that kind of it was almost a bit of an illogical bridge in some ways. But the parts kind of fit together. So it was like, well, you know, if they happen to have a lot of freeze-dried Thunder Warrior corpses as part of their, you know, science mission that they were doing in the time leading up to the Horus Heresy, why not try to staple a capacitor in each of them and get their hearts pumping? But then, you know, the decision there was to make it like partially because with the Custodes rules, I wasn't sure how fun they would be to play against on a long-term scale. I've had quite a bit of fun as an opponent, but I know some melee armies are very frustrated against Custodes by and large, so I didn't want to make it like my thing. So the idea like, well, Thunder Warriors don't live a whole long anyway, so it was they're gonna have a ticking clock, and then you kind of presented me the perfect opportunity to kind of swan song them with this big last stand against the demonic hordes that, and I mean, have you talked about it on the podcast before? That double perils from Theodosius and his second in command there at the start of that battle really set the tone for, I think, a really critical moment.
Yeah, that game was weird, and
you know, I've compared it to, have you seen that movie Hero, that Chinese martial arts movie Hero? Where two you know, warriors are sitting down and they play out a really well choreographed fight sequence that's supposed to be their sort of imagination as the fight goes on, and I compare that battle to that scene because we pulled like a couple NPCs at the very start, and then you took the measure of the table, and I remember you saying to me like, well, I actually don't think I can win this. And so from that point on, it became a very cerebral game of like, well, okay, you could move here and you could move here and then this happens here. And we, it was the last game of a pretty long, you know, long 2 days. So we got to relax a little bit, you know, and enjoy the theory crafting half.
Yeah. And we also enjoyed a bit of storytelling as well, but it was a great game because we were able let's take a stick on the steps back. Yes. The mission itself was on a very crowded board, and you were able to advance, spawn some NPCs, which is a thing you can do in the Pyrexian events, and that blocked my movement pretty heavily, and I knew I was never going to be able to secure the central objective, which is the way you win the game.
Yeah. It was some really unfortunate pulls.
But it was also not, because it was also a really great... it was a really fun story at the same time, because everything went perfectly for the narrative, even if the gameplay wasn't great. Yeah. But it didn't matter because me and you had brought into the story.
Yeah, I mean, like that's how it used to be. You look at a lot of the old, like, I've got this fourth edition book in my lap here. You know, you look at, like, the raid missions, right? There's a lot of very narratively driven missions that are absolutely lopsided from, like, the standpoint of an actual, like, you know, fair competition between, you know, two players. But if you are not buying into this as, like, a competitive thing where you are trying to crush the other opponent, if you're looking at it as like you're collaborating, you're telling the story, you're showcasing, you know, your hobby craft together, losing becomes a joy in some instances. And I was called an insane person for believing this, but I truly think that, like, you can have some of the most fun having your entire army get, like, rolled over by a series of catastrophic explosions in an apocalypse game. Now, who survives? Who doesn't? That's pathos. You know, that's yeah. Real storytelling. It doesn't always go, you know, for your side. You're not always gonna win every fight. But if you're always having fun, you know, if you're always, like, keeping an eye out for those narrative moments, I think it's a great solution to, you know, any hard feelings you might have about a game. If you buy in fully, no matter the outcome, you're going to have a great time.
Yeah. And it's sort of one of those things, I mean, particularly that game, the objective for you guys trying to get the data out the ship, and you were trying to hold off word bearers. And it was a very weird game because I wasn't losing models. I just couldn't get models to where they needed to be. So it did sort of have.
I was losing models in great droves, but
it was definite
the final point.
A definite feel of, like, those last minutes in action movie, like, which is, you know, it was a very, you know, narrow.
And
when
we had decided the outcome of the game, there were some parting shots in there that were as exciting as anything that had happened, like the orbital bombardment you called on. The noble that I'd kept in the back flank, you know, all the Thunder Warriors throwing their bodies on top of him to keep him from getting melted and dying in the process.
Yeah, it was, we knew that obviously the game can go certain ways. So, like I said, it's orbital strike I'd been sitting on, so I dropped it on a choice target. Yeah, it was.
Yeah.
And those are the memories that stick with me because I'm thinking about the game and I'm trying to actually think about, and all I can think about is, you know, my commander charging and wiping out that creature squad and the engines at engine room and then the orbital strike on the remaining Thunder Warriors. And
there's a, to your point about, like, the best moments come later, there's a moment that was kind of a footnote in the game, which is kind of now, like, the driving emotional force of this this book that I'm working on. Do you remember that Imperial Navy officer that got, you know, picked up and then eaten in the demonic tide?
Yes.
Yeah, I have, and this is a funny little note. So I had been kind of walking around with an expeditionary navigator all four games.
Mm-hmm.
Picked them up at the start, you know, and so I kind of ended up crafting for this character this idea that, you know, this is maybe, if the last mission is going to be a crashed spaceship, then clearly that's where this navigator came from. Now, retroactively, This navigator has been trying to get back to this officer, you know, who's been sending an SOS, like, you know, my colleague here, my comrade, we could save them. They get within radio range and it's, you know, like, oh, we're being overwhelmed. Save yourselves. You know, that absolutely brutal gut punch of not being able to save that person ends up kind of defining the course of my entire campaign, you know? And so it's like, you gotta look for it. There are gonna be moments like that in any game you play to just keep your eyes open, you know, keep invested in the moment and in the game you're playing, and you're gonna find something that's gonna really hook you. It's practically guaranteed.
No. So one of the things I think is really important is that though me and you have spent the entire time saying, oh yeah, you sit down and talk to your opponent about it, you don't have to.
That's true.
Going back to the conversation I mentioned earlier about my first real narrative I wrote about the Illuminated Dragoons, which were my Space Marine chapter. I wrote nearly their entire story based off tournaments I went to. So I would play through the tournament, and I'd go home, and then I'd write a bit more about the background.
I'll clarify. Like, I don't mean, like, you know, like, record the names of your opponent's forces and, you know, yeah, just, sorry.
Sometimes that sort of step back allows you to smooth off some of the round edges. Like, in the Illuminations of Grun story, they never fought against any other named characters. If someone brought a named character, they were turned into some generic hero. That way my story was contained, but I also at the same time had a story that was, like, wasn't just, oh, my Marines are great, they win all the time.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's good to keep that in mind, right? Because as passionate, and I think we're two guys that are both pretty passionate about, you know, the narratives for these stories, not everybody has to be, you know. I've played with people that don't name their characters, you know, like, these are the units I like on the table, I like playing the game, you know, and that's good enough for them. And that's, like, I can completely understand that mindset, you know. So you can look at your fellow players as great collaborators, but you don't have to tie yourself into that. I think it's a point well made.
And another, on the other side, if you're bearing with us through all this and you've been like, okay, I want to involve stories, but I don't want to name characters. You don't have to.
No, not at all.
I don't want to specifically model characters. Telling a story can be about being. Telling a good narrative can just be about, well, my entire army is the story. I don't name any of my heroes, but you can talk about this entire company as a thing.
It does help you get around, like, those moments when you don't have a Theodosius. You know, if your character is dying every time, it can be like, well, you know, how many times can I say he was pulled off with a stretcher and then made ready for the next one, right? So if you want to make the whole army one character in a lot of ways, I think that's there's a school of thought there that I think is pretty worth interrogating.
And if you've got, like, generic enough looking models, I have heard one of the good systems I've heard before for people with large horde armies is to name particular characters, just have the names work their way up. So a name starts as a sergeant, and after a couple of battles with everyone dying, that sergeant's now in charge of the entire company. There's a lot of ways to do it, and you don't have to be like, oh, this guy's been particularly modeled to be this dude. It's like, no. They are game pieces, so they can be a little bit abstract at the same time.
I'll point anybody that's interested. If you ever want to get into this, obviously, you know, Games Workshop has changed a lot as a company. You know, as all companies do, right? You know, they're composed of different people that have, you know, different ideas of doing things. A lot of this logic that we've talked about today was really encouraged in, like, early books and source materials for you know, Warhammer 40K. So if you are interested in stuff like this specifically from a wargaming perspective, I mean, the back half of this fourth edition book is a gold mine of, like, you know, here's an orc knob that gets modeled up into a war boss, that gets modeled up into a special character with the serial numbers filed off over the course of a campaign. You know, there's guides out there on how to do this stuff. And so just some Googling, you know, some creative library usage, you can get a lot of information. And I'd also say, you know, turn to sources on, like, traditional role-playing games. A lot of the same logic and ideas can really carry through. So if you like reading, it'll make you a great writer. That's one of the oldest pieces of advice I can give.
Actually, and that's one other thing I think it's worth. I am not one of nature's writers. I suffer a variety of problems when it comes to writing. But I found, much like painting, just doing it and not necessarily sharing it and just spending time enjoying my own creativity eventually got me to a point where I was comfortable enough writing things that I wanted to share. If you're like, oh, I don't want to write anything, I don't want to share anything. Well, I've just talked about, like, my Illuminated Dragoons a few times. And apart from the occasional post on the Bolter and Chainsword, I'd have to say that, you know, like, 95% of the stuff I wrote about them never appeared anywhere. It was in a Word document or it was a Google document, and it was something for me. In fact, in some ways, the Amber Strand story here over this last year has been the first time I've been like, okay, I'm writing something for a deliberate aim of sharing it with other people. And I think there are really good communities out there, people willing to talk about the stuff. I know the Taking a Pyrex Discord as a great channel for discussing army narrative. But I know Pyrex is just a US, even a Midwest part of the US story, but it's not the only narrative thing out there. I know when you go out to the West Coast, G3 guys out there are doing some pretty cool narratives, mostly Titanicus and stuff, but, you know, it's all the same. You go out the UK and like you hear plenty of stories of really fun narrative story games being done. You don't need a giant organized, you know, event series to tell a narrative.
Honestly, the most rewarding continued narratives that I've ever been a part of have been with my, you know, college D&D group who've kind of stayed in contact over the years, right? Like we played, if you've ever heard of Exalted, the RPG.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. So we started out in like second edition, my I think sophomore year of college. And over the years, we've played like maybe 10 campaigns set in our version of this world. And, you know, different generations of heroes come up, you know, different areas of the world are explored. We've got, you know, an absolute metric ton of consolidated lore that nobody besides like six people will ever care about or ever care to know about, you know? So it's all up to you. However much time you want to put into it, however rewarding you find it, that's the correct answer. So, you know, I encourage any... Yeah.
I definitely think putting some time in, even if it's just for yourself, will make your collection feel something more.
Absolutely. I don't want to like anybody that's, you know, like feels discouraged about doing something like this. It's really worth a try. If you don't find it's for you, you know, that's what it is. But if you've never tried it before or you've been intimidated by it, put yourself out there, you know, or keep a running record. Start writing down the outcomes of battles and it'll come to you.
And like I say, once again, it's not, you know, you don't need to know exactly how many people killed. We're not talking about, you know.
Don't write down how many Marines you've lost. You'll very quickly outpace the numbers in the setting.
But no, just keep to those beats and look for those points where your games feel like the setting. And it will enhance everything. It's like that extra spice.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's the unique privilege, I think, of Horus Heresy as a system, as a setting, as a community, how open this stuff is, right? You know, you get to a table, you're usually going to have something to talk about, you know, whether it's literature, whether it's other games you've played, you're going to have something in common with the people that you're playing with. So it's a pretty unique opportunity to let yourself get invested and then, you know, talk to people that are going to be, you know, if not as invested, then in the same ballpark.
Awesome. I think we've talked about this for a while. I'm sure there's like another 2 hours of stuff we talk about, but we'll look to wrap it up here. It's been an absolute blast. Thanks for coming on, talking about all this with me.
Hey, any time. I had a.
Is there anything you want to sort of touch on before we're done? Anything we haven't really had a moment to talk about?
No, I think we pretty much broke down all my important points, you know. Don't overload yourself. Do as much as feels right. Start small and then let the game speak for themselves. Emergent narrative is the way to do it. You're gonna look for the stories that are popping up. Most importantly, have fun and play dice games. I think that would be the best way to put it.
Yeah, awesome. Absolutely. So everyone listening, it's been an absolute pleasure. I will see you again in a few weeks. As per the last episode, I'm not going to tell you when the next episode is going to be. Life is randomly busy, especially as we steer towards the holidays. But I've got a few ideas of things I'm going to put together. And when the next one's out, it will be out. And until then, I wish you all a very great evening and great fortune.
Please subscribe to the podcast on your podcatcher of choice, and we will see you in 2 weeks. If you have any questions for the show, please email us at firesofbetrayal@gmail.com or reach out through our social media accounts or at us at their respective owners. Until next time, we wish you all good fortune.